All right, today I'm joined by Dr. Paul Manning from Dalhousie University, and we're going to have a quick chat about No Mo May, which I'm saying very intentionally slowly, because when I've been talking to other folks, like, what's No Mo May? And it sounds like, you know, some, I don't know, dish that you'd eat somewhere at a certain exotic restaurant or something. So Dr. Manning, would you mind taking a, oh, and sorry, just to clarify, unfortunately, if you're watching this on YouTube or some other video hosting platform, Dr. Manning's video is not working. So we'll just hear his lovely voice, not being able to see a smiling face. Dr. Manning, would you mind just quickly introducing yourself, just what you do at Dal and what your background is, please?
For sure. Yeah. So I'm an assistant professor at Dalhousie in the Faculty of Agriculture, and I'm an entomologist. So I study insects and I study the importance of insects to healthy ecosystems.
Wonderful. And to my understanding and my uneducated understanding, that's an important premise behind the concept of No Mo May. Prior to the interview, I didn't see whether you were pro or con No Mo May. And I just kind of want an honest picture of, like, what's it all about. I've previously thought it sounds like a good idea, but I'd love to hear from an expert like yourself. Would you mind outlining what is the premise behind No Mo May? And is it, in your opinion, a good idea or not so good idea, or maybe totally a net neutral idea?
So yeah, No Mo May is basically a public campaign meant to help pollinators. And we have lots of different kinds of pollinating insects. This tends to be targeted towards bees. And the whole concept is that for the month of May, that you do not mow your lawn. And this allows some flowering plants to flower and provides a little bit of extra food for bees that might be having a hard time finding other things to forage on at this time of the year.
And does that apply to other pollinators as well?
Yeah, there's other pollinators that are out this time of year too. One of the really cool ones you can see is called a bee fly. It looks like a bee, but it's only got one set of wings, where a bee has two, and they're kind of like extra poofy. They're kind of little cotton balls, and they're early on the wing. So you can see them anytime in early May. They'll start to become more common.
And in terms of other pollinators, and again, not my area of expertise, I think I've heard that butterflies, perhaps, or maybe hummingbirds are also pollinators. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. There's lots of different animals that act as pollinators. Moths are very important pollinators. Butterflies tend not to be great pollinators because they tend to feed most of the nectar, and their bodies aren't kind of fuzzy enough to pick up most pollen and move it around. Bees and flies and beetles are the three groups that really do the lion's share, where bees are actually the ones that are kind of most important for most plants.
And so did you say flies as well?
Yeah, lots of flies are pollinators. And flies get a kind of a bad rep because people tend to associate them with house flies, but there are hundreds of thousands of different kinds of flies. And some of them are very, very effective pollinators. And some crops are, like, so cocoa is pollinated by a little tiny midge. Mangoes are pollinated by flies too, and lots of our wild plants are pollinated by flies.
And just where here in beautiful Nova Scotia, we're on the cusp of black fly season. So should I be feeling guilty when I squish those black flies when they're trying to bite me and my kids, or are they not pollinators? Or maybe I should feel guilty about it for other reasons, but are the black flies pollinators?
Black flies, I remember reading a study years ago about black flies as pollinators of blueberry, because that was one of the hypotheses, that when blueberries are blooming, especially low bush, the black flies are tend to be really bad. And I looked into that, and I think they were not effective pollinators of blueberry, but it's very, very common for adult flies to take a little bit of a nectar meal. And sometimes that can also kind of correlate with a little bit of pollen transfer. So I wouldn't say they're super important. I don't feel too guilty about killing black flies when they're feeding on me, because it's an unpleasant sensation. And for everyone you kill, you're probably going to miss killing a bunch of others that are feeding on you.
Touché. Yeah, the numbers game, they win every time. So that makes sense. I'm just wondering, does flower, and I maybe I'm making this up, but I thought at one point I heard that flower bed weeding was also kind of in a similar category, like, you know, maybe hold off on mowing the lawn and hold off on getting too crazy with weeding the flower beds, because that can provide a habitat for some of these critters as well. Is there any merit to that, or is that off base?
Certainly. And I think I should probably backtrack for a second and just mention, you asked about my opinion on NOMOME, and I don't think I gave you one.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. That's me just not having a great memory. But NOMOME is, I think it's a really good first step in terms of making our garden a more ecologically friendly place. It's kind of like the first, a really good first step for lots of people who are sort of inheriting the values that were, you know, the society teaches us as to what a garden space should look like, you know, fertilized, nice and green, a single species of a plant being some sort of turf grass. I think it's a really valuable way to be thinking about our lawns and our gardens more broadly as green spaces and spaces that have value for biodiversity. But I think there's many different levels that you can, or many different approaches that you can take, just like you mentioned about flower beds. Having a lawn and taking part of that lawn and putting it into a flower bed where you're purposely growing flowering plants, that's going to have a stronger impact for pollinators than just by not mowing for 1 month.
That makes a lot of sense. And so just to clarify, so I think if I'm understanding you correctly, so one could consider converting, like as maybe a next step beyond just avoiding mowing in May, they could potentially convert some of their lawn to, you know, a garden, like other plants. So there's more biodiversity there. And then is it also a good idea to, for the sake of pollinators and maybe other critters as well, to hold off on weeding the flower beds until June as well? Or does that maybe not have as much of an impact in terms of the weeding?
Yeah. So, I guess weeding, you can think about a cleanup in a few different ways. Like weeding would be removing other plants that are, you know, not desired in the garden. And some of those plants can provide some additional food sources for insects. So they're good to leave. What a weed is really a matter of perspective, right? It means something very different to someone, depending on what you want in your garden. So for me, for instance, if we get a lot of violets in our garden, I'm happy to leave them. They take up space. They look nice. They have flowers for a while. They have interesting foliage and lots of things eat them, including some nice butterfly larvae. I would say like that, a lot of insects will overwinter, spend the winter in the soil, kind of in dead grass clumps or in hollow stems. Some bees do that too. So if you can kind of tolerate a little bit of messiness in the garden, I think that's a really good thing that you can do to help support the insect numbers that are living locally.
Okay, great. And I guess maybe somewhat on that note, like, is there any, aside from, you know, maybe having a messier garden, but if we're all kind of on the same page, like, oh, of course we all have messy gardens until June, that's okay. It's just the, you know, new norm. Aside from the aesthetic aspect of things, is there any downside that you can think of to, holding off on mowing one's lawn or getting right in there in the garden until June?
Well, I think one of the downsides is that, you know, sometimes when you're talking to people, relationships matter in your neighborhood. You know, if you're suddenly just stop mowing your lawn, you may find yourself receiving a ticket from a bylaw enforcement group or a complaint from a neighbor. And there's this really useful framework that was kind of designed around this by a very influential landscape architect. And the idea is that nature is messy by default. You know, there's a certain degree of an ecosystem does a lot of things, and some of it doesn't look so pretty, including decomposition. There's a lot of time when this is, you know, there's a lot of brown things that are rotting on the surface or slowly being degraded by microorganisms and insects and other invertebrates. So the idea is that if you can kind of signal to folks that what you're doing here is, this is a purposeful intent. Whether that's a sign that says, hey, I'm not mowing my lawn for May to help support bees, or whether it's, you know, clipping a clean edge that delineates the part of the lawn that you're not mowing from the rest of the lawn. So maybe you have a certain area of a few meters by a few meters that you're leaving to go long and go to flower. That's, you know, you can keep that edge defined and still indicate that you're regularly mowing and caring about that space. Painting a foundation of a home or painting a little fence, making sure that you're indicating that you are caring for that ecosystem, even if it does look a little messy or like there's lack of care.
Yeah, those are great thoughts. And yeah, that feeds into one of the other questions I was going to ask you, like, how can you diplomatically, you know, kind of broach the subject with neighbors and whatnot? So that's really great advice. I recall, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I feel like there was, I'm not sure who the group was that was doing this, but there was some type of campaign which kind of got the No Mow May on my radar at the time. And I think I remember seeing that there were some signs or like templates for signs that you could download. Do you know offhand if there's any group or website where there's kind of a template that folks can download things or print things off, or any sense of that?
Yeah, there's a lot of like sort of grassroots organizations that are kind of running with this. Here I am, and I'm in Truro. There's a fantastic community group that's partnered with local schools to make these signs that are going out. So that's a really interesting connection between the community and especially working with youth and just bringing that important message to them too. Mm-hmm. But there are certainly, if you search No Mow May, there's lots of different environmental NGOs and like municipal governments that are encouraging this as an intervention.
That's great. I'll find some sites and put links in the show notes. So I'll have that available for listeners after the fact. And just on that note, in terms of municipalities that are supporting this type of initiative, do you know if there are any municipalities in Nova Scotia that are kind of actively behind No Mow May?
That's a good question. I know there's, I did hear that, I think it's maybe somewhere on the South Shore is doing it, whether it's Lunenburg or Chester or Mahone Bay. I've heard that someone was driving through recently and saw quite a bit of signs, but I'm cannot specifically recall if that was a municipal endorsement or an NGO that was pretty active. So,
Okay. And I guess just kind of circling back to the whole premise of No Mow May in the first place. So, I mean, logically, it makes a lot of sense. Just wondering, is there like research evidence or some objective evidence that it is definitely a good idea to, does it have, I should say, a meaningful impact on our ecosystems as a whole? Any objective data, or is it more of like a theoretical, like it makes sense type of initiative?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When you go into there was a paper that was out maybe a year ago or 2 years ago that showed an impact of No Mow May on pollinator abundance and diversity. And unfortunately, that paper has since been withdrawn just because there was some inconsistencies with the data that the authors wanted to address. And I've kind of got my eye out for it. It hasn't been reinstated or published again. Certainly the science behind it makes sense, particularly if you have an area. So where it could really make a big difference, I think, is if you think about let me take one step back. So No Mow May is not going to be a very effective intervention if the lawn that you're not mowing is purely like a turf grass, and that's heavily fertilized, heavily treated with pesticides or fungicides. That's not going to be a high value ecosystem or habitat for insects, even if it does go from 1 inch to 6 inches, of growth in a month. That's, that's not going to have a huge benefit for wildlife. If you are someone though who has a weedy lawn that's not so perfect, isn't being limed and fertilized, and there's lots of other plants that are kind of hanging out in there that are small, and then you allow them the chance to grow, that'll have a bigger difference. And then again, like thinking about No Mow May as a first step, replacing some of the lawn with a garden or introducing some other habitat features like deadwood is a really good source for a lot of insects. So again, it comes down to tolerating the sort of messiness. If you picture what a more naturalized ecosystem looks like, implementing some of those habitat features can certainly have a benefit. And you can think about it this way too. Like if you have for monarch butterflies, that's one of the ones that they're exceptional butterflies. They're so fun to watch. They're very distinctive, and you will not get a baby monarch butterfly in your yard unless you have milkweed. So there's a few different species of milkweed. that you can plant. And in most places, you're likely to get a monarch butterfly visiting to lay her eggs. And that's exceptional to watch. So like you all seem to think about what the needs are of the insects that you want to attract. And there are lots of good options out there for plants that are, you know, friendly, or plants that are good choices to really best support insects. And you can find those on like the Nature Conservancy of Canada would have some good resources on that. So would the Xerces Society, which is X-E-R-C-E-S. It's a society for invertebrate conservation.
Oh, so sorry, could you rhyme off those letters again? Sorry, I'm going to add it to the show notes.
X-E-R-C-E-S.
Oh, X-E-R-C-E-S. Okay, that was a society, did you say?
Yeah, it's a society for the conservation of invertebrates. And they have some exceptional lists of plants that are tailored to specific regions. So you can see what will work well for your particular region.
Okay, great.
Another really good thing to do is plant a tree. We know that urban trees are very, very important for human health and well-being. We know that they have a cooling effect, especially in places with lots of impervious cover, like asphalt and cement and things. And trees also, you know, have tons of leaves, and those leaves are food for all kinds of different insects. So picking ones that are really, really high quality food, oaks are like kind of the one of the best things that you can do. They're a lovely tree. They last a long time. They're nice and strong, and they feed a ton of insects.
Fantastic. And just kind of on the topic of like ideal plants to be planting, or in this case, kind of incidental plants that nobody ever plants, but they pop up anyways. Dandelions are very popular in many parts of Canada, especially here in Nova Scotia. Seems like even the folks, my neighbors that I see where I know they spray their lawn, we still see those dandelions coming up. They're mighty, mighty tenacious. And I've heard some rebuttals, I suppose, in some of the forums where I've like, you know, I'm posting about like no mome, and then someone's like, oh, like bees don't even like dandelions, or they don't even use them as food. So are dandelions actually a meaningful source of food for any pollinators, to your knowledge?
I mean, certainly they're visited by a lot of insects. The argument with dandelions is that they're a non-native species, and so that's theoretically they're out competing native species for the same resources, though they tend to, you know, live in pretty disturbed areas and grow in many places where other plants can't grow. If you look at like the quality of the nectar and the pollen, it tends to be quite, they don't produce a lot of it, and it tends to be pretty low in quality as well. So if for the case of pollen, that's measured in like protein, and for nectar, it would be measured in like sugar concentration or amount of volume of nectar that can be extracted. So they don't tend to be amazing. There's lots of other better things out there, but they're certainly better than nothing.
Gotcha. Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, Dr. Manning. Is there anything else on this topic that I should have asked that I didn't ask, or anything else you'd like to share? Or did we cover it pretty well?
Oh, I think that's a good coverage. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for the questions, and thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Well, thanks so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Hey, take care.
You too.